put me into your life because you needed a mama, didn't he? She said quietly. Again I nodded, now holding her hand, as she gazed out at the grand expanse of the sea. But baby, she said softly, I didn't know he was bringing you into my life because I was gonna need a baby girl. Her voice caught with emotion, and I put my arms around her, tears rolling down my face as well. She wiped her eyes and turned to face me. Will you be my baby girl, Roma? She asked me. Yes, I said, my heart welling with emotion. Well, she said, lovingly and with strength, then I am your mama. I am your mama. Now in that moment, I was longing for my real mama and Della for her real baby girl. But we were also overflowing with gratitude to God for giving us each other to fill the holes in our aching hearts. God had a plan for us. We didn't know the comfort we would find from loving each other, but God knew. The redemption of our losses doesn't make the pain go away. It doesn't mean the loss didn't happen, but it does mean that even in the darkest moment, there can be light again. The real hope is not in something we think we can do, but in God, who is making something good out of it in some way we cannot see. Thomas Merton. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing, a time to search and a time to give up as lost, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear apart and a time to sew together, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. That which is has been already, and that which will be has already been. For God seeks what has passed by. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 verses 1 through 15. NASB. Let me not pray to be sheltered from dangers, but to be fearless in facing them. Let me not beg for the stilling of my pain, but for the heart to conquer it. Rabindranath Tagore. Struggles make you stronger. Just when the caterpillar thought the world was over, it became a butterfly. English proverb. Mark and I had the privilege of bringing the epic story of Ben-Hur back to the big screen, a huge undertaking that involved lots of talented people, much travel, and a big crew for special effects. But there is a small moment in the film, probably one that most people won't even notice, that has come to mean so much to me. It comes toward the end of the film, as Judah Ben-Hur has just accomplished what he was striving to achieve for the entire film, revenge. He, along with his mother and sister, had been wrongfully imprisoned for the attempted assassination of the governor. He has just won the epic chariot race that led to the demise of his longtime nemesis, Messala. But as he stumbles out of the arena and looks around, he's surprised to find that instead of being filled with triumph from his victory, he feels profoundly empty. This driving force had been his mission for his entire life. Now, having achieved what he thought he so desperately needed, he realizes that his victory delivers no fulfillment. As Judah begins to walk down the street, he sees a man being forced to carry a heavy wooden cross. The man is surrounded on either side by Roman guards, and Judah can see how deeply the man is suffering. Remembering his many years as a slave, forced to walk long distances with no water or rest, he rushes up to this poor man to offer some water. But the Romans kick him away. "No water for him," they yell. In anger, Judah grabs a rock to defend the man carrying the cross, but the man looks him in the eye and says, "I give my life of my own free will." Judah stops in shock and watches the procession continue. He follows along silently as the group walks to the place where this man is crucified. Judah can't look away. As the man takes his last breaths, Judah hears him say, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." The man on the cross is, of course, Jesus, and Judah is so overcome with emotion that he drops to his knees. He finally understands and knows what he needs to do. Revenge didn't quench his thirst, but forgiveness will. Judah looks down at his hands. He's still clutching the rock that he grabbed back on the street to defend Jesus. And as forgiveness fills his heart, he is able at last to let it go. The rock drops to the ground, and he is finally free. To me, that scene represents the need we all have to let go, to surrender, to hand our burdens over to God. Sometimes, like Judah, we don't realize how much we are carrying and how much it is weighing us down. Sometimes we carry anger like Judah, other times disappointment or sadness or regret. Usually the burden we carry stems from the struggles in our lives. We all have the opportunity to kneel before God and lay our stuff down. He will always take it, and therein lies such freedom. What is weighing you down? What loss have you experienced that you haven't been able to truly grieve or let go of? Could you, like Judah, drop that rock and finally open your hands to receive what God wants to bestow? God is always looking to redeem, restore, renew, and forgive. Loss is part of our lives, but it is in those times of darkness that God forges a new person. Just as the caterpillar must go into the darkness of the cocoon to become a butterfly, we often find that God's loving redemption is strongest in our most painful suffering. God is always looking for ways to transform us through our circumstances if we will just let him in. We must remember that through the struggle, God is building our wings so that we can soon emerge a new creation, stronger than before, and able to fly. God is the ultimate creator and miracle worker. He can make anything from our lives, no matter what they look like. He can make beauty from ashes, winged creatures from creepy crawlies, light from dark, life from death. It is when we stop and listen for him, for grace, that we can remember the truth, that we can reframe what is happening. Though the facts remain the same, a simple reframing of the story can change the ultimate experience and, of course, the ending. Then I can see the truth. I've not fallen into a deep, dark pit that I cannot get out of. Rather, this darkness is forging my new being. If I have learned anything, I know this to be true. There is no growth without pain. The very things we struggle with actually give us the strength and character to become who we are. Think about the fact that the butterfly begins as such an ordinary bug, but then it becomes a stunning creature that can fly great distances. Did you know that monarch butterflies can fly up to 3,000 miles during their migration? That they can fly at speeds up to 20 miles per hour? Some pilots have actually seen them at an altitude of 11,000 feet. The beauty and strength of a simple butterfly reminds me that with God, all things are possible. You can choose to stay a caterpillar crawling on the ground your entire life, or you can subject yourself to the transformation process, the pain of metamorphosis, and become someone who, with God's help, can fly to the highest heights, move at great speeds, and explore the world with wonder and gratitude. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. Romans chapter 8, verse 18, NRSV. Japanese bowl. I'm like one of those Japanese bowls that were made long ago. I have some cracks in me. They had been filled with gold. That's what they used back then when they had a bowl to mend. It did not hide the cracks. It made them shine instead. So now every old scar shows from every time I broke. And anyone's eyes can see I'm not what I used to be. But in a collector's mind, all of these jagged lines make me more beautiful and worth a much higher price. I'm like one of those Japanese bowls. I was made long ago. I have some cracks you can see. See how they shine of gold. Peter Mayer. Thank you, God, that though our hearts break in this world, you are always there. Thank you that during my darkest moments you were carrying me, even as I felt so alone. May I hold fast to the hope that you provide, that you can raise the dead, that in the dark light is coming, that ultimately all brokenness will be healed, relationships restored, that wholeness and peace is our birthright. Like it or not, we either add to the darkness of indifference and out-and-out evil which surrounds us, or we light a candle to see by. Madeleine L'Engle. It is better to light one candle than to curse the darkness. Author unknown. Chapter 2. Kindness. No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or his background or his religion. People must learn to hate. And if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love, for love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite. Nelson Mandela. I was born in Derry City, Northern Ireland, a beautiful border town in the northwest of Ireland. Yet throughout my childhood, my town was filled with tension and violence that began when I was about 8 years old. I grew up in the midst of a war that has become known in Ireland as the Troubles. Ours was a story of neighboring people wanting different things and being unable to find common ground. The Catholics desired independence from the United Kingdom, hoping to become part of the Republic of Ireland, Republicans, while the Protestants wanted to remain a part of the United Kingdom, Loyalists. Both sides harbored animosity, distrust, and prejudice toward each other. When the violence between the communities began to escalate, the British Army arrived. But before long, it became clear that those sent in to establish peace became an army of occupation, and the conflict only increased with their presence. As children, we would sometimes get detoured on our way home from school because of bomb scares or gun battles. We learned from an early age to hide behind cars and walls, quickly becoming little experts on telling how close the gunfire was. If it was a loud crack, you better take cover quickly. If it was more muted, you were probably safe for the moment and could continue on your way home. The town I loved so well. But when I returned, how my eyes have burned to see how a town could be brought to its knees by the armored cars and the bombed out bars and the gas that hangs on to every breeze. Now the armies installed by the old gas yard wall and the damned barbed wire gets higher and higher with their tanks and their guns. Oh my God, what have they done to the town I loved so well? Phil Coulter. We lived on the same street as John and Pat Hume. John was one of the great politicians of the day, and was instrumental in bringing peace to Northern Ireland and went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize. My mother and Pat became great friends, and their young daughter, Mo, was named after my mother. Not long after my beloved mom passed away, I went to the cemetery to put flowers on her grave for Mother's Day. It was chilly and damp, and the wind blew sharply on the hillside where she was buried. I had bundled up in my favorite red woolen cape with fake fur trim, to protect me from the sharp chill in the air. I was with my auntie Ruby, my mother's only sister, and we brought with us some beautiful pansies, my mother's favorite flower. My eyes were filled with tears as I placed this small offering by her tombstone. Her absence in my life had broken my heart, and as we stood by her graveside, I missed her so desperately I could hardly breathe. I longed to hear her laughter and the sound of her voice calling my name. I ached to feel the warmth and safety of her arms around me. I didn't know if my mother could see me, if she could see the flowers I had so carefully selected for her. I longed to have her back. My auntie's hand was on my shoulder when we heard the first loud gunshot. We both dropped to the ground instinctively, but this area of the cemetery offered no protection. A wide, lonely hillside on a cold afternoon. And here I was, wearing a bright red cape. My aunt pulled me to my feet and we began to run to see if we could find a large gravestone to duck behind. The shots rang out and we saw a few others running for cover in the area around us. "Get down, get down! Get down where you are," a man yelled at us, seeing my bright red cape and realizing how much of a target it made me. My aunt pulled me to the ground just as we both smelled a scent like burned hair. She covered me with her body as we lay on the cold, wet earth, praying for protection and hoping that the battle would end. Finally, the shooting stopped, and after we were certain it was over, we cautiously picked ourselves up off the ground and embraced in gratitude. Then with my hand tight in hers, Auntie Ruby hurried me down the hill toward the safety of home. As soon as we opened the front door, I ran to our kitchen, tears streaming down my face to find my dad. He held me close as my aunt told him what had happened. He rubbed my back, calming me down. But then he grabbed the hood of my cape and said, "Ruby, come look at this." And there, on the fake fur trim of my hooded red cape, was a large, singed hole where a bullet had narrowly missed my head. "Oh, thanks be to God," gasped my aunt as my father nodded. "Yes, thanks be to God indeed." Years later, when Della heard that story, she said, "There were angels watching over you that day, baby." That's for sure. Growing up in such troubled times planted in me the desire to work towards creating peace in the world. The River Foyle divides Derry, and as the troubles escalated, the communities on either side of the river became more and more segregated. It broke my heart to see our town split in two, so much anger and fear and sadness and loss on both sides. But my dad refused to give up hope. He always looked for ways to build bridges. He always spoke of tolerance and love. He taught me that we should reach out to each other in neighborly love and support. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II. In those years, I listened to the music of Simon and Garfunkel and replayed their cassette over and over. They sang of a bridge over troubled water. Clearly we needed that in our community, and indeed we would rejoice to finally see a new peace bridge opened over the River Foyle in 2011. But back in the 1970s, my dad encouraged me to explore how we each could be that bridge in our own lives. How we could be angels of peace in the lives of others if only we were willing to let God use us. My dad reminded me that we just needed to have the eyes to see the opportunities and the openness of heart to see each calling to love. He taught me to pray and to ask God for his guidance in my life. I always remember my father saying, "Love is a verb." Quiet by nature, he was more prone to performing small acts of kindness than peppering you with words of adoration. He was a thoughtful man, and I adored him. After my mother's death, I became more attached to him than ever. He was a schoolmaster and later ran a mortgage loan company, and in our predominantly working-class neighborhood, he was very well respected, not just because he had a college education and wore a shirt and tie every day, but because he was never condescending to people. He was respectful and kind, and even though people in our community called each other by their first names, my dad remained Mr. Downey to many. He volunteered to teach grown men in our community to read and write, yet did this discreetly to allow these men their pride and privacy. He was always seeking to help the world in little ways, and his acts of kindness spread far and wide. His example has been an inspiration to me my entire life. It has caused me to commit to treating people with kindness and respect, and to be on the lookout for ways to brighten someone's day. It's easy to get busy and forget to share simple kindnesses, but I know from experience that little acts of compassion add up to a life of great significance. I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. Maya Angelou. Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as you ever can. John Wesley. The flannel sheets. Actions speak louder than words. Mark Twain. I was 18 when I finally left Derry. As the troubles continued with no sign of letting up, my dad knew an education would be my passport to a new and bigger life. So with his blessing, when I graduated from high school, I went first to Brighton College of Art in the south of England, and then on to London and drama school. In London, I rented a room in one of those big Georgian houses that had been converted into flats. I missed my dad and went back to visit as often as I could. It was late in the spring of my last semester in drama school, and I was planning a trip home to Ireland to stay with my father for the unexpected ordination of my eldest half-brother, John. John was many years older than me and had felt the calling to the priesthood late in his life, so it was a surprise for all of us. I knew how proud my father was that his oldest son was going to become a priest. In the absence of cell phones, the lodgers in my flat shared a black payphone in the chilly hallway by the front door. As I telephoned my father to confirm my travel arrangements the day before my flight, I pictured my small town and the grand celebration I knew was being planned. When I heard my father's voice on the other end of the line, a feeling of safety immediately washed over me. The sweet sound of his lilting voice was so comforting and familiar, even over the phone. We discussed my early flight the next morning from Heathrow Airport to Belfast, how I would be picked up at the airport, and that I would be home in time for tea. As we wrapped up our call, my father, a man of few words, said that he was so glad I was coming home, and that because of the ever-present dampness in our Derry air, he had hung my favourite yellow flannel sheets on the indoor line to air. Our climate in the north of Ireland is damp at the best of times. To this day, when it rains in Malibu, I affectionately call it a Derry day. This was a time before dryers, and we just had a wash tub and a wringer to do the laundry. In Ireland, we were rarely able to dry anything outside due to the rainy weather, so people in our town had indoor clotheslines, usually in the kitchen, where there might be a stove to provide warmth and dryness. I went to bed that night imagining the soft, cozy feel of those flannel sheets, prepared for me by my loving father. My little suitcase, packed for the trip and slightly frayed, was standing ready at the end of the bed. In the middle of the night, the guy from the front flat began pounding on my door. "Wake up, Irish," he yelled, "and tell your bloody family not to call in the middle of the night." My heart skipped a beat as I rushed out of bed, fear flooding every step down the cold hallway in the dark. I lifted the heavy receiver, delaying a moment longer before I finally whispered, "Hello." My brother Lawrence was on the phone. My dad was dead. Lawrence told me it was sudden. Apparently Dad's heart gave out. I did not know what to do. I must have said something. I must have hung up the telephone. I know I slid down the wall and sat in the dark. I'm not sure for how long. I was in shock. I'd just heard his voice. I'd just spoken to him. How could he be gone? How had the very thing I feared most since my mother's death really happened? I remembered how my dad had always said, "If you can bury your da, you can do anything." I knew I was no longer a little girl. I was making my way in the world. I knew how proud my father was of my life in London, my dream of being an actress. But I still wanted him here. I didn't want to have to bury him. I knew I could not sleep, so I went back to my room and waited until the sun came up. Then I took the flight I was scheduled to take. But now my journey home had a whole new, unwelcome purpose. By the time I got to Derry, my father's body had already been returned to our brick row house for the wake, our front door displaying the black bow of mourning. In our loving Irish tradition, we still lay out our dead in our living rooms for the great parade of friends and family and neighbours coming to pay their respects. The Irish wake is designed to provide the family with love and support as they send off their loved ones and say goodbye. I walked into our dark little hallway and past the room where he lay. I was not ready yet to see him dead, needing first the courage that comes only from a cup of tea. Tea, the Irish solution to everything. So I slipped into our kitchen, so familiar to me in every way, and a vision took my breath away. For there, hanging on the indoor clothesline to air, were my favourite yellow flannel sheets, the last loving act of a most thoughtful man. I held them to my face, breathed in their kindness, and cried. John walked into the room and saw me standing, holding the sheets. Not knowing of the last conversation I had with my father, he was focused on the practical, the fact that we would soon have countless friends and family streaming through the door to pay their respects. "Oh, we have to get those old sheets down before people come calling," he said as he went to put the tea kettle on. "Oh, not yet, not yet," I said quietly. I wanted those sheets there while I had my cup of tea. One final reminder of the kindness of my father, of how during his last moments on earth he was thinking of me, his youngest daughter, and how he could best welcome me home. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So now, faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But the greatest of these is love. 1 Corinthians 13. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. It is in dying that we are born again to eternal life. Prayer of Saint Francis. Do not think that love, in order to be genuine, has to be extraordinary. What we need is to love without getting tired. How does a lamp burn? Through the continuous input of small drops of oil. If the drops of oil run out, the light of the lamp will cease, and the bridegroom will say, "I do not know you." Matthew chapter 25, verse 12. My daughters, what are these drops of oil in our lamps? They are the small things of daily life. Faithfulness, punctuality, small words of kindness, a thought for others, our way of being silent, of looking, of speaking, and of acting. These are the true drops of love. Be faithful in small things, because it is in them that your strength lies. Mother Teresa. What is a smile worth? If you want to lift yourself up, lift up someone else. Booker T. Washington. Many years ago, on the very first season of Touched by an Angel, we shot an episode that featured the organization Operation Smile. Operation Smile was founded to provide a safe, simple surgery to the countless impoverished children who are born with a craniofacial anomaly, usually a cleft palate or lip. This is a common issue occurring in one of every 500 to 750 births. Doctors can repair the lip or palate easily, and usually do so in the United States by the time the child is 3 months old for a cleft lip, or by the time the child is between 12 and 18 months old for a cleft palate. Yet across the rest of the globe, many of these children do not have access to this straightforward 45-minute surgery. It was a powerful episode to film for both the cast and crew, and viewers across the world were deeply touched as well. I soon became actively involved in the organization as a spokesperson and began to travel around the globe, helping them on their mission to change the world one smile at a time. Many of these children are born into cultures where stigmas are attached to such an anomaly, where it is viewed as a curse and a shame on the family, with no hope of a cure. Some children with cleft lips and palates cannot eat properly, or smile, or speak. The mothers of these children worry. They worry that their children will never have a normal life. They worry they will die. They pray for a cure, not realizing that one exists. And then they hear rumors about this medical group coming, a group of doctors who supposedly have the ability to fix faces, and a seed of hope is planted. This seed of hope drives these women to walk miles or get on a bus to go to far-off places, all in hopes that their child might be chosen and given a chance at a normal life. They arrive and see our faces and our smiles and our brochures with pictures that promise a fix, a solution to the problem that has plagued their beloved child since birth. And so they hand their babies over. They hand them over to strangers who don't even speak their language. Talk about a lesson in trust. They trust that with Operation Smile, there is a chance. My favorite moment in every mission is when 45 minutes after a mother has handed over her baby to outsiders, she sees us emerge from surgery and give that baby back to her. It is like a rebirth. The child, whom that mother thought would never get to smile, smiles up at her for the first time. She is shrouded in joy and gratitude. Tears stream down her face, and we all rejoice together in the power of healing, in the gift of second chances. The first time I had the chance to give a healed child back to his mother, I was crying just as much as the mother. I looked at the child I held in my arms. His beautiful little face had been perfectly repaired, and I carefully carried him out to where his mother stood, alone and silent. She had been praying, fear and hope battling in her watchful gaze. Her face brightened when she saw us walk toward her, and her eyes quickly found her child's face. There was her little son, perfectly restored. And she cried, this time tears of relief. Now her child would have a normal life. It was one of the most amazing moments of my life, second only to the birth of my own little girl. To be the one to hand back a restored child to its mother, to see this mother's greatest prayer answered, felt like being one of God's angels. And I've learned that the operation doesn't just change the life of that little boy or girl or mother, but when they travel back to their villages and the villagers see this little child restored, it creates a ripple of hope for the whole community. Because if that little baby's dreams can come true, maybe it can happen to them. Maybe taking a risk or taking a journey to see what might be out there could be the beginning of a new life. I can't even begin to describe how powerful it is to see hope renewed in a person's life. When I go on these missions, of course I want to help people. But really, I do it selfishly too, because I too am transformed. To see the doctors and nurses who are volunteering their time to make these dreams come true fills me with a sense of hope and possibility. They are the angels. I watch as they train local doctors to perform these surgeries so that after they are gone, hope will remain. Watching them reminds me of the gifts we all have to share with the world. As the old Chinese proverb says, give a man a fish and he will eat for a day. Teach a man to fish and he will eat for a lifetime. When I witness the courage and trust that God instills in these mothers, the trust to bring their babies to these doctors, I'm reminded of the goodness of God and how he truly performs miracles through his children every day if we are willing. I love the founders of the Operation Smile organization, Dr. Bill McGee and his wife Kathy. I am grateful to them for their example and their friendship. They possess the empathic eyes to see the great need for this organization, the brave heart to see the possibilities, and the faith to try to help. If we don't take care of that child, there's no guarantee that anyone else will, Kathy says. What if they had just shrugged their shoulders and said, oh, how sad, but did nothing? What if they had waited for others to step up? But they didn't. They knew that God calls all of us to care for one another. We sometimes think we have to do huge things to change the world. We don't. We just have to have the eyes to see the needs around us and to use the capabilities God has given us to help in small ways. God is waiting for us to be his hands in this world. We should be shining lamps, giving light to all around us. Catherine McCauley. When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping. Fred Rogers. How wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. Anne Frank. An unexpected angel. You can preach a better sermon with your life than with your lips. Oliver Goldsmith. For almost 10 years, I was able to deliver a message of faith, hope, and love on network television. More than 20 million people tuned in each week to hear the message, God loves you. We would take them on a journey and remind them that they are never truly alone. Because of that message, When people ran into me on the street, they didn't necessarily ask for an autograph. I wasn't just an actress they admired. I was an angel. They wanted a hug. When you play an angel on TV, people begin to think you are an angel in real life. Sometimes when people met me, they spoke quietly and reverently, as if they were in the presence of someone holy. Now, I am the first person to tell you that I am just as flawed as everyone else, that I am far from perfect. But playing an angel for almost 10 years not only had a positive influence on the audience, it had a huge impact on me as well. I began to realize that we all have the opportunity to be an angel if we are just willing to show kindness and grace and love to those around us. For the almost 10 years that I lived in Salt Lake City, I often went to Primary Children's Hospital to visit the children who were sick. The people of Salt Lake City treated us very well for the entire 10 years that we filmed there. They took pride in what we were doing and embraced us like family wherever we went. I had gotten into the habit of stopping by the hospital when I could to provide a moment of joy for the many families who had sick children, and I would often visit the tiny babies in the NICU. If the parents weren't there, I would sometimes take a Polaroid of me visiting their baby and leave it on the incubator with a note saying that an angel had visited while they were gone. Over the years, I met many of these children in the neighborhoods where we filmed. A mom would show up with a now robust toddler to thank me and tell me that my visit had given them hope at a stressful time in their lives. One day around Christmas, I was at the hospital. I was wearing a Santa hat as a way to bring a festive spirit to the families who were sequestered in those halls. As I walked down the corridor, excited to see the next patient, I saw a family exiting one of the rooms. I quickly pulled off my hat and backed into a corner. There was no question what this family had just experienced. You could feel the grief gust like a wind out of this room. But the mother looked up, saw me, and gasped. She rushed over saying, "Monica, here you are." She grabbed my hands and said, "Oh, Monica, I prayed that an angel would come for my baby, and here you are, here you are." I stiffened, not knowing what to say. My heart ached for her. Monica was the name of the angel I played on television. But I wasn't Monica. I was just Roma. I wasn't an angel. I was just a normal human being. I didn't know what to say. This grieving woman had enveloped me in a hug, and she had just experienced the worst thing a parent can experience. So I just held her. I wrapped my arms around her and prayed quietly with her. I prayed with all my heart. After a few moments, she pulled back and looked me in the eyes, tears still streaming down her cheeks. "Thank you," she said quietly. "That was just what I needed." And then she returned to her husband and family, still huddled just outside the room, and they all walked down the hospital corridor. I stood there, my heart beating fast, overwhelmed with emotion, but also questioning whether I had been dishonest. That woman wanted and needed an angel, and all she got was me. But I also saw the comfort that my presence had provided. If I could make her smile through her tears, maybe I had done the right thing. If I had made her believe in God's faithfulness, perhaps everything was okay. When I got home that evening, I sat down and called Della to tell her the story. "Oh, Della, I didn't know what to say. I was afraid to appear to be something I'm not. I should have said something, but I could not find the words." Della laughed. "Baby, I don't understand what you're so upset about." I tried to explain again, but Della, she thought that God had sent an angel to her. To which Della said, "And who said he didn't?" She paused. That woman didn't need an actress, baby. She needed an angel. And if we are going to be used in this series for his highest good, then we need to learn to get out of the way. As I hung up the phone that evening, I prayed, thanking God both for using me and for Della, who, as always, possessed the wisdom I desperately needed. Who was I to say God wasn't using me in that moment? How many times had I limited him and not been available to be a light to someone who needed it? That moment has stuck with me through the years, and I've tried to be attuned to the ways that a simple act of kindness on my part might be the very thing a person needs, the very thing to remind them that they are not alone. The dictionary defines angel as a spiritual being that serves especially as a messenger from God. We are all spiritual beings, and we all have the ability to be messengers of God. I know Della has been an angel for me, as has my own precious daughter, Riley. My husband has been an angel for me more times than I can count, and for our boys. I pray that I will be an angel to others every day. We are all here together, during the good times and the bad, the ups and downs. And sometimes we need a hand to pull us up, and at other times we have the strength to reach down and encourage someone else. That is what the family of God is here to do. Keep walking forward, eyes heavenward, as we do the work of our Maker. In that moment, when that grieving woman probably felt so heartbroken and alone, God used me to remind her, I'm here with you. I'm always here. Trust in me. Trust in me. In my books, and sometimes even in real life, I have it in me at my best to be a saint to other people, and by saint I mean life-giver, someone who is able to bear to others something of the Holy Spirit, whom the creeds describe as the Lord and giver of life. Sometimes, by the grace of God, I have it in me to be Christ to other people. And so, of course, have we all, the life-giving, life-saving, and healing power to be saints, to be Christ's, maybe at rare moments even to ourselves. Frederick Buchner. Loaves and fishes. This is not the age of information. This is not the age of information. Forget the news and the radio and the blurred screen. This is the time of loaves and fishes. People are hungry, and one good word is bread for a thousand. David White. Lord, may I be reminded of your presence in my life. May I have the eyes to see the needs of your people. May I have a heart to feel them and the willingness to see how I might help. May I see each of your children as my own and seek only to be a bringer of light. May people see me and be inspired by the goodness in the world. May kindness be my mantle and my sword. I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear. Nelson Mandela. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Psalm 27, verse 1. Chapter 3, Courage. Promise me you'll always remember you're braver than you believe and stronger than you seem and smarter than you think. Winnie the Pooh, A.A. Milne. The word encourage means to embolden one with courage, and I'm so thankful for the many people in my life who have emboldened me, urging me to go after my dreams. It began with my mother and her loving enthusiasm, signing me up for dance and music classes, and her quiet, loving support from the back of the room at all those lessons. It continued with my father, who pushed me to pursue an education and who always told me I was strong, capable, and smart. But they weren't the only ones who planted the seeds of courage and confidence in me. By the time I graduated from art school in Brighton, I knew I wanted to be a professional actor. I had studied the work of the Dutch artist Vincent van Gogh, and he said a curious thing in one of his many letters to his brother Theo. Growing dissatisfied with his work, he expressed that he no longer wanted to be the painter, but rather he wanted to be the paint. When I read this, I instantly understood it in some unspoken way. I wanted to become the paint in my work, to breathe life into a script, to become a character, to tell a story. I wanted to be an actor. I realized my dream was to be on stage. I decided the best way to achieve this was to further my studies at the drama studio in London. I interviewed twice and was finally offered a place at this prestigious school. I was thrilled and so excited about the quality of training I would receive, but my heart sank when I was turned down for a grant to cover the cost of the tuition. I knew I couldn't afford it on my own and was trying to process my disappointment when a miracle occurred. Three extraordinary people who I'd been working with on a summer theatre project banded together and offered to put up the money for me to attend. They told me they believed in me and wanted to invest in my future. It wasn't a loan, they assured me. It was an investment in me. They didn't want me to have to turn down this wonderful opportunity. The only thing they asked was that I pay the kindness forward with my life. And I have tried to do that over the years to honor their generosity. I had never experienced such unbelievable, unselfish kindness before. But before I could accept, I told them I had to talk it over with my father. My dad was stunned. Of course, he wished he had enough money to pay the tuition himself, but it was more than our family could afford. Knowing this was an incredible opportunity for me, he said he couldn't let pride stand in the way, and he gave me permission to accept. These three wonderful angels gave me so much more than just the tuition fees. They gave me encouragement and confidence. They stepped up and showed that they believed in me, a belief that made all the difference. It made me want to work as hard as I possibly could to show them their investment in me was worthwhile. I didn't want to let them down. The agreement was that they would cover the tuition, but I needed to get a job to cover my rent and living expenses. I wasn't afraid of hard work, and I immediately got a job as a waitress so I could cover my costs. I excelled in my studies in London and even went on to win the highest award the school offered, Most Promising Student of the Year. Then just 1 month before graduation, my father died. I was devastated. Not having him with me at the pivotal moment of accepting my diploma broke my heart. I wanted to see his eyes shining with pride as I walked across the stage, his heart bursting with the knowledge that my whole life was still in front of me, beckoning. So here I was, finally out of school, and my beloved parents had both passed on, and my childhood home in Northern Ireland had been sold. I was trained and ready and eager to start my professional life. Some of my friends in the program were planning to move to New York after graduation. I began to wonder if I could take that leap of faith as well. I was a young woman with a big dream, and I knew that the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. I was scared, of course. The unknown opened up before me. But when nothing is certain, everything is possible. I prayed I would know what direction to take, that I would be guided to each next step, and that I would have the courage to take it. Looking back, I can see that if my father had still been alive, I might never have considered moving to America.